This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The Briefing Room, 28 minutes in which you and I get the top experts to explain a big issue of the day. This week, just how sewage-filled and chemically polluted are our rivers, canals and lakes? And why? Imagine, it's been raining overnight, again, but the new day is warm and bright, nice enough to take a walk beside the river. Maybe even take a dip. You've got one foot in when you notice a change in water colour, and then a whiff of sewage. This is exactly what wild swimmers were complaining about this summer, that waters all over the country are not the pristine natural watercourses we imagine them to be. Why is there so much sewage in British rivers? What else is in there, and what could be done about it? Step into the briefing room and we'll find out. Parliament's environmental audit committee is in the middle of an inquiry into water quality in rivers. Next week, it will hear evidence from the CEOs of some of the main water companies. According to the charity The Rivers Trust, more than half of England's major rivers are polluted with sewage. Not one river has what's known as good chemical status. Joining me in the briefing room to discuss the state of rivers is Olivia Rudgard, the environment correspondent at the Daily Telegraph. Olivia Rudgard, how bad are British rivers in terms of water quality?
So the most recent figures that came out towards the end of last year make for some pretty grim reading. So what they found was that of waterways, so that includes rivers, canals, all types of fresh water, only 16% were of good ecological status and none of them were of good chemical status. So what that means in practice is that essentially all of them failed tests for water quality. And the other thing that we have is that we only have one designated bathing point in the country, which is up on the River Wharfe at Ilkley. I think a lot of people have this perception that rivers, you know, you can swim in them in the summer. It's one of those things that I think people will remember from their childhoods. But actually what you see is people coming down with sick bugs and things like that when they do that. And it's not really something that on paper you're supposed to do because of this chemical pollution problem that we have.
If I went to a particularly poor river where nevertheless I would find people swimming, what else would I find in the water?
So it would really depend on the particular pollution problem. And sometimes that can vary even from sort of week to week, because there are really two sources of pollution that cause a problem. I mean, there are more than that, but the two major ones are pollution from agriculture and pollution from sewage. So if you think about pollution from sewage, you know, there are some really nasty things that can sometimes end up coming out when, for example, you have a raw sewage spill, which is something that happens far more often than I think most people realize it does. So wild swimmers and litter pickers have reported finding tampons, other sanitary products, some really unpleasant things. You know, if you think about what goes down the toilet and sometimes things that shouldn't be going down the toilet as well, those things have been found on riverbanks. And more broadly, you know, I was speaking to some rowers this week who row on the River Thames, and, you know, they say it just gets really smelly around where their boathouse is and their boat ramp. When there's been a spill, you know, you really notice that sewage odour.
Can you tell us why people put sewage in our waterways? I mean, if I went along with a whole lot of nasty stuff and dumped it in the river, somebody would arrest me, wouldn't they?
Yes, I mean, you would hope so. You would hope so. And enforcement is actually one of the problems here. But a lot of campaigners in this area say that the Environment Agency enforcement just isn't where it needs to be. But yes, so raw sewage, the figures that we have show that in 2020, so last year, that happened 400,000 times. And the year before that, it was sort of just about half that. that increase, the Environment Agency says, is due to increased monitoring. So basically what we have are these things called combined sewers. What that means is that you have sewage from households and businesses, and that combines with rainwater that sort of runs down into drains and into the sewage system. And it was built that way. It was supposed to be built that way. It's not a sort of a breakdown of the system. It's the system working the way that it's supposed to. But what's happened is it was built under a Victorian system. And for a Britain that was, you know, much greener, had much more sort of natural soakaways, as they're called, which is that's another way of saying like a green field or something like that. Whereas now we have obviously a much bigger population. There's a lot more strain on the system. There's a lot more sort of concrete and hard surfaces, water going into that system. And what that means is that rather than overflowing just very rarely in really exceptional circumstances, it's happening much more often.
Now, another problem might be that we are simply going to have more rainfall events. It could be one of the consequences of global warming. And my understanding is that the sewage companies, the water companies, are entitled to dump this stuff at a point where there's an overflow.
Yes, absolutely. They are. And climate scientists say that because of climate change in this country, we are getting just these much more frequent, quite heavy bursts of rainfall. So what that means is that you're getting quite sudden, large volumes of water falling, and that's putting quite kind of acute pressure on the system.
So what's the reason they give for doing this?
This is the system working as it's sort of designed to, and the reason it has this escape valve, as it were, where the sewage is going out into seas or rivers, is actually that in times of high rainfall, when the system is sort of overflowing, historically, the worry was that that would then end up backing up into streets and houses, and then you'd end up with sewage and sort of areas where people live, which is obviously something that would be absolutely terrible and we really want to avoid.
So in other words, we've chosen to put the sewage into the rivers rather than have it back up in our own bathrooms.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
How do we compare with other countries in Europe who presumably are experiencing the same problems and who also have rivers and waterways?
So if you look at the figures that I mentioned earlier, 16% of waterways are in good ecological condition in this country. In Europe, actually, that figure is 53%. So you can see the difference there in terms of the status of their rivers versus ours. I mean, it's been said, there was a report that came out from an environmental charity last week, which said, you know, we have among the worst river pollution problems in Europe. The other thing to look at is bathing. So in this country, as I said, we only have one designated bathing spot in a river. There are 32 of those in German rivers and 420 in French rivers.
Can we actually tell if things are getting better or worse? You said that the Environment Agency said, well, we're monitoring more, so you'd expect to see more incidents. Over and beyond that argument, can we tell whether it's going up or down?
It's very difficult to tell kind of empirically with data. I was actually looking at trying to do that earlier this week. And what we can see over time is that a lot of these combined sewer overflows didn't have sensors on them to be able to say, yes, this is when this is happening. And the water companies in recent years have come under much more pressure to be transparent with that data. So we have much more of it now than we used to have. I think what we can say is that we know that these water systems are coming under this pressure. We know that the amount of sewage going into them has increased really significantly over the past few decades. And, you know, if you talk to the water companies, they say, look, this is something that we are experiencing, that a lot more is coming into the system. You know, they sort of hold their hands up about that. So the logical conclusion of that is that it's going to be something that's happening much more frequently. But whether we can put kind of a number and data on it is difficult.
Olivia Rudgard, let's zero in on sewage. Professor Peter Hammond is a mathematician and a retired computational biologist. He lives by the River Windrush in Oxfordshire. Over the last decade, he's been doing a lot of measuring of sewage outflows. Peter Hammond, you've been measuring sewage spills into rivers and waterways. What exactly have you been measuring and what have you discovered?
So I've been particularly looking at illegal spills of untreated sewage into rivers from wastewater treatment plants. And actually, my motivation is because I have a river running through my garden and I've watched it decline. So that's how I got interested. But don't think I actually put waders on and get into the river and measure anything. I'm actually a mathematician, not an ecologist. And so what I do is I use what are called environment information regulation requests, a bit like freedom of information requests, to get data, to extract it from the water companies about sewage treatment. Now, it's interesting, extract's quite an apposite word there, because what I've found is the water companies find it very painful to provide what I asked for. They delay, they obfuscate, they send me 5 million lines of data to try to overwhelm me. They say a rat bit through a cable, so no data was recorded. And another actually refused to provide me with a list of sewage works on the grounds of national security. But eventually I get the data, and that tells me when the sewage has been fully treated and when it has been spilled untreated or at best partially treated. And I compare that to what the Environment Agency says is legal or not legal at a particular works, and I identify what's illegal.
So, Peter, can you give me some examples of what you found?
I found quite a few small rural sewage works in Oxfordshire that actually spill sewage illegally for 6 months without a break, which is dreadful. Then you have examples like the mighty Mogden sewage works in West London, which spilled last year 1 billion litres of partially treated sewage in a day. Now, that's the equivalent of 16 Olympic-sized swimming pools an hour.
What are the rules about such spillages?
You have to separate out treated sewage, which is called the effluent, from the actual spills of untreated sewage. Sewage works are allowed to spill untreated sewage when they're under pressure. And that happens in this country because we don't separate the kind of road and surface runoff that happens when we have rain. That gets mixed with the wastewater, so the works get overwhelmed, and so they have permission to treat an excess. But the actual treated effluent has a set of quality standards. For instance, it might be that only a certain amount of ammonia is allowed per litre of what comes out of the sewage works treated. But I've been focusing on the untreated sewage, and there are two important rules that I've been looking at. First of all, it must be due to rainfall. Secondly, even when you're spilling, the works must continue to treat an agreed level before the spill takes place. So you've got to keep on treating even when you're spilling. And there are two catastrophes associated with those rules. The first rule says just rainfall. It doesn't say how much. So there's a bit of a loophole there for water companies to actually exploit. The original EU legislation said that spills to rivers are allowed, but they must be in exceptional circumstances. Catastrophe number two is that second rule that says you must continue treating to an agreed level can't be tested because very often the sewage works don't have a meter measuring what's going to be treated. And for example, I've found out that one water company has 800 works, but only 20 of them have a meter recording the treatment that's being carried out. Another one has 700 works, and only one of them has a meter actually measuring the treated sewage.
Why isn't there a regulator telling them how much data they should keep and under what circumstances they should spill?
Well, of course, there is. I mean, the Environment Agency are the regulator, and they set on paper in what are called discharge permits what each sewage works must adhere to. But unfortunately, they don't insist on the detailed information that I get hold of being provided to them. So, for example, they just ask for summary data. So they say to the water company, for each works, just tell me how much gets treated every day, how many hours in a year you spill. But what I ask for is how much is being treated every 15 minutes every day, and when do these spills start and when do they stop? So I have 100 times more data than the EA routinely uses. They only come back to water companies if they suspect there's a problem. How does that suspicion arise? Well, for example, somebody might notice pollution in the river, or they may see dead fish. But many of these rivers are so polluted, there aren't any fish to be killed. So by not having the fine detail and constantly scrutinising it, the agency are missing spills that are illegal.
I don't want to be crude about this, but what essentially you're saying is, unless somebody spots a turd in the river, they don't think they've got a problem.
Well, worse than that, sometimes people may spot a turd, report it, and the agents say, well, were there any dead fish? And if there weren't, they say, well, it's not an important pollution event. We won't come and look at it.
Are you saying that there is a case here of significant regulatory failure?
I think that's one of the major problems. The agency are probably so overwhelmed because we know they're undermanned that they can't actually get round to inspecting all of this data. And it's certainly true, for example, I found that the water companies provide inconsistent and incomplete data. And recently I've found, for example, that the agency probably only is recording less than 10% of all the spills that happen. So when that data is provided it must be incomplete and incorrect. So that means policy is being based on incomplete data.
On a sunny day, if you go up to Oxford and Godstow Bridge, you can see the kids jumping into the River Thames. Would you advise them to carry on?
Thames Water have now instituted some warnings to people where you get a text message that says you shouldn't be swimming maybe in that area. Of course, getting a warning is one thing, and yes, I would advise people to adhere to that warning, but what you would really like to do is to stop those spills in the first place.
Peter Hammond, what else is going into our rivers and what can we do to fix it? Joining me in the briefing room is Steve Ormerod, Professor of Ecology and Co-Director of the Water Research Institute at the University of Cardiff, and Rachel Salvage, who is Deputy Editor of the ENDS Report, a specialist environment magazine. Steve Ormerod, we've heard a lot about sewage spills in rivers being a problem. What other pollutants are going into our waterways?
We clearly live in a very complex world as far as the water environment is concerned, because our rivers, our lakes integrate all kinds of things that are going on in their surroundings in what we call the river catchments. So there are potentially problems generated out of agriculture, out of general urban runoff, things like tyre dust and tyre particles. And of course, we have the traditional problems associated with wastewater, sewage, the CSOs, what we call combined sewer overflows. Some of the problems are agricultural nutrients. Some of them are toxic chemicals such as pharmaceuticals. Metal mines also still a problem.
When we talk about those other things, what can we say about whether they are a bigger problem or not than they have been up until now?
I think it depends where you look. And I, for some time, have been thinking that the general trajectory of the British river environment was one of urban recovery, but rural degradation. So if you go back into the 60s and 70s, large parts of the industrial areas, the urban areas of Britain were really seriously, grossly polluted. Now, there is some evidence from biological data that a range of clean water organisms have progressively recolonized those areas. These are things like Atlantic salmon, otters, river birds like the dipper. So some contradictory evidence, in fact, from biological recovery about around what some people might think urban rivers now look like. That is not to say that they are absolutely free from all problems. And these continuing problems with combined sewer overflows clearly are problematic. We still have issues with things like pharmaceutical products. We still have problems, or we now have problems with things like microplastic. So in urban areas, there is a shift from traditional growth problems to some of these novel, complex pollutants probably starting to cause problems. The rural environment is potentially on a different trajectory. And there are concerns about spillages from agriculture, silage spills, slurry spills, particularly in areas of dairy. We know that there are nutrient problems. We've heard a lot about places like the River Wye, for example, and how that is affected by things like phosphorus and nitrogen that could quite easily give rise to things like algal blooms and algal problems.
Rachel Salvage, who other than wild swimmers should be directly worried about this?
I think it's something that everybody should be concerned about, because you don't have to be sort of submersed in the water to be exposed to the impacts of some of these chemicals, whether it's the more recent discoveries that PFAS, for example, which is a group of thousands of chemicals which are man-made and they're designed never to break down in the environment. Those have been found by the Environment Agency to be, what they say, ubiquitous in the environment. And they're toxic to wildlife and they're toxic to human health if you're exposed to it at particular doses. We know, for example, that pollution that seeps into groundwater, which is then abstracted and used as drinking water. I mean, the drinking water is obviously treated to very high standards, but it's only able to treat a certain number of chemicals, which it's been designed to treat. And we have new chemicals being, you know, created all the time that it doesn't filter out, and that water companies are not actually looking for at the moment, because there are no rules to say they have to look for.
Steve Ormerod.
Very clearly, I think we've got to look at evidence from things like pharmaceutical products, of which anything, whether it be antidepressants, antibiotics, anti-inflammatory agents, diabetes treatment, epilepsy treatment, in the end, we excrete that material if we are users of those products. It finds its way into surface waters downstream. And at this point, we are not fully aware of just how big the risk to organisms in rivers might be and just how much of that risk might actually come back to affect us. We know from some of the work we've done looking at polychlorinated biphenyls, flame retardant chemicals, that they accumulate through food webs. They reach elevated concentrations in the eggs of birds that live along rivers, for example. And we have some evidence that those concentrations are large enough to cause some kind of developmental change in chicks of birds that are exposed to those chemicals. One of the really interesting areas of health risk is around, in particular, antimicrobial resistance. And in fact, in the freshwater environment, there is quite good evidence that now there is a kind of tendency towards bugs, bacteria that could be increasingly resistant to antibiotic material. While swimming and surface, for example, people who are in contact sports with water are something like four times more likely to have antibiotic resistant bacteria in their body, in their guts.
Rachel Salvage, how much monitoring goes on at the moment?
Well, it's quite hard to say exactly how much monitoring goes on, but there's a couple of regimes that the Environment Agency has. There's a spot sampling regime, and there's where they keep monitors in place for a longer period of time and have real-time data coming from them. But Environment Agency staff have told me that they see that spot sampling regime as meaningless. They've said it's a ludicrous waste of money and a gross misuse of data because sampling rivers once a month or less is going to miss intermittent pollution events, such as a raw sewage spill or runoff from farms in bad weather, and that even that has been radically cut back. They do have these monitors that stay in place and can report real-time data, but they only have around 150 of these. So as you can see, if you know, thinking of all the watercourses in England, there are massive gaps in data.
You use the term cut back. Do we actually have fewer people monitoring less than we did before?
Yes, we definitely have fewer people monitoring less. The agency's budget overall has been cut by two-thirds since 2010. So I think it was about 120 million in 2010, and it's around 40, 45 million now. And more recently, Emma Howard-Boyd, who's the Environment Agency chair, has written to George Eustace, the Environment Secretary, saying that some activities will have to be paused or halted because they can no longer do them because they no longer have the funds and resources.
Steve Ormerod, what are the solutions to this?
Clearly, there is a very substantial need here for investment and action that really we've got to roll out across a whole range of sectors, be it agricultural, be it urban, be it associated with water companies. From the rural point of view, we've got to move very clearly to better management of catchments, agricultural production operating to better standards. We've got to find ways of appropriately funding things like cover crops that take up nutrients rather than release them, reverting from arable in some cases to grassland. We've got to be careful about the way we manage slurry. And in some instances, just having general binding rules around the way people can do things in river catchments is quite an important step. And there are some really interesting schemes developing now around what we call markets for ecosystem services, payments to farmers, for example, to do the right kinds of things that might reduce the costs on water companies in having to treat water problems somewhere else. The set of circumstances around the urban environment, wastewater, are slightly different. Every 5 years, the water companies go through what is called an asset management program, a price review that is regulated by the water company regulator Ofwat. And over the next 5 years, we'll be looking at something like a £50 billion expenditure to essentially do a range of things, look at leakage, look at, in some cases, new reservoir development, new pipelines. But a substantial amount of that funding is earmarked for reducing pollution incidents. Very clearly, however, this can be really, really expensive action. if you look at the problem of combined sewer overflows, even in somewhere like Wales, like I live and work, estimated cost, if we were to address all of the CSO problems that we have, we'd be looking at something in excess of 8 to 12 billion, so about £3,500 per individual person.
Just to deal with combined spillage overflow, sewage overflow, just for that.
What that essentially means is that we've got to very clearly prioritise where we invest the resources that we have. But we are on a process of trying to address the problems through a whole range of appropriate actions.
Rachel, how do you see the future? Because everything we've talked about is either A, a lot of money at a time when the government thinks they're overstretched, B, taking on a lot of vested interests who might not want the bother of doing this, at a time when there are all kinds of other problems. So are you optimistic?
It's difficult to be optimistic, but I agree with Steve that it is about investment, but it's also about, which involves investment, more robust monitoring to sort of better understand the problems in the first place so they can be solved at source. That requires better funding for the Environment Agency so it can return to its policing role rather than what it appears to be more of an auditing role. And it would be good if the Environment Agency, when it pursues a polluter through the courts and achieves a fine, that fine could go back to the Environment Agency potentially rather than the Treasury, because one of the big deterrents for the Environment Agency pursuing a polluter through the courts is that it costs them so much money. So that, coupled with legally binding water quality improvement targets that forces action and accountability from polluters and from the regulators, I think those things are very much needed. And couple that with a strengthening of the precautionary principle, which would dictate that you can't put certain chemicals, substances, pharmaceuticals out into the world until they've been tested and proven that they're not going to create harm to wildlife or to people, because at the moment, things such as some of the chemicals that we've mentioned have gone out, and it's taken 10, 20 years for science to catch up and NGOs and campaigners to catch up to be able to prove that these are bad for human health or for the environment. And then retrospectively, you can't remove them, especially if they're forever chemicals and they're going to stay in the environment. So it's hard to be hopeful, but I think, you know, this problem has moved up the agenda. I think the government is acting because of the pressure and the exposure that it's getting these days. And I think as society wakes up, that pressure is going to increase and things will start to move. And with the Environment Bill going through Parliament at the moment, the government has just added a few new amendments to the Environment Bill, which will actually require water companies to do more and require government to report on progress in reducing things like combined sewer overflow discharges.
Steve Ormerod, are you optimistic?
I think in the end, we all consume food, we all produce sewage. The problems in fresh waters are essentially arising on behalf of all our activities. So there are systemic ways that we, I think, have got to look at the way we live to help to reduce some of the pressures and problems that are on the environment. One thing that does make me optimistic is that for a very long time, the problems of fresh waters in Britain, in Europe and around the world have been out of sight and out of mind. And I think that the fact that now environmental NGOs, citizens are shining a spotlight that is probing into these sometimes murky waters gives me hope that there is the potential for action to change and improve what is in the end a critical life support system and a critical resource for all of us.
Steve Ormerod there with Rachel Salvage. And my conclusion, your rivers shouldn't smell like a toilet. Getting them not to involves better data, regulation, and enhanced investment in replacing antique infrastructure. Maybe we'll do it, maybe we won't, but at least now we're thinking about it. My thanks to Olivia Rudgard, Peter Hammond, Rachel Salvage, and Steve Ormerod. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were John Murphy, Kirsty Knight and Soila Aparicio. The sound engineer was Neil Churchill and the editor is Jasper Corbett. And if you enjoyed this podcast, you might like other editions of The Briefing Room, which are all available on BBC Sounds. And recently we've explored non-fungible tokens, the UK's energy crisis, what happens when universal credit uplift is stopped, and the threat to peace in Taiwan.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.